Hello, folks. I'm Jay Light, and this is another episode of Blockbusting. I'm really happy to have you guys here and listen to me and my friend Nate Fisher, wonderful comedian, performer, see him at the Pack Theater as part of the Brutus sketch team performing there monthly. We get real dirty, real climbing through shit pipey about the Shawshank Redemption. So stay tuned for more fun times as we tear into one of the top movies on IMDb and of all time, according to some folks who like being emotionally puppeteered. Today, I want you to join the Facebook group, subscribe on Patreon, change the levels up. It's $2 if you want to get some stickers and some patron exclusive things, $5 for the Blockbusting Film Club. And that's about it, guys. I've said my piece. Enjoy today's episode with Nate motherfucking Fisher. Oh, let me tell you something. Busting makes me feel good. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Blockbusting, the podcast where we love to hate the movies. I'm your host, Jay Light. Joining me today, Nate Fisher.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, I'm good. How are you, man?
I am phenomenal.
Wonderful.
I'm doing great.
Happy to have you. Happy to have you here. You and I talked about having you on the show a while ago.
Uh-huh.
You're a film buff, film nerd.
Big time snob.
Love it. And that's the heart of the podcast. And you hit me up with quite a list of movies you want to talk about.
Because I looked at, like, everybody that's on your podcast has pulled all these different movies, and I a lot of really famous ones, some obscure ones. And I was like, well, I'm going to look at the top, like the IMDb top 250, see like what the like biggest one that I can like, you know, shit on is. And I looked and I was like, well, man, there's like seven good movies on here. Like The IMDb top 250 is just swill top to bottom. And I was like, well, I do hate The Shawshank Redemption. Surely that's been done.
It hasn't.
It's the number one. And that's the first one. I was like, by any chance, was this like the third episode you did? Like somebody had to have done The Shawshank Redemption. And apparently no.
No. Amazingly enough, no one has touched on Shawshank Redemption.
And that's why I wanted to do it, because this movie has too much universal praise. And it just gets ushered along. It's like, yeah, number one. Sure. Why not? It's great. Everyone loves it.
That's the thing. It's so crazy to me. Is like, I remember, so Shawshank Redemption, 1994 American drama film written and directed by Frank Darabont, based on the 1982 Stephen King novella Rita Hayworth in Shawshank Redemption, tells the story of Andy Dufresne, sentenced to life in Shawshank for the murders of his wife, despite his claims of innocence. Over two decades, it befriends fellow prisoners, gets involved in money laundering. You got Tim Robbins, you got Morgan Freeman, box office bomb, critically acclaimed. Got bought super cheap to be aired on TNT in perpetuity.
Yeah. This is the like number one in the canon of TNT Sunday afternoon classics.
Absolutely.
You know, like you're the last samurais of the world. Movies that like get pulled from the 90s and early 2000s, just like dustbin of history,
yeah,
and get a new second life. The number of times I've seen Troy on TNT, like there's just so many movies. Like, why is this still, everyone has seen this
right
now because of TNT.
It's always either like Van Helsing type action movies.
Yeah.
Or schmaltzy dramas like
you meet
Shawshank
Joe Black.
Redemption.
Yeah. No,
so your beef with Shawshank Redemption, though, because I never saw it for a long time. I watched it, first time I ever watched it was on a plane when I was in my 20s, early 20s. I completely missed it when everybody was like, oh, this is the movie. When I discovered IMDb, I was like, what's everyone love this movie for? And I watched it on a plane and I was like, oh, okay, that's a good movie in my mind. But now, this is the first time I've ever heard somebody who has some detractions against it. So what's your beef?
Yeah. This movie has always bothered me. I remember watching it when I was like real young, going like, oh, this is nice. This is really sick. Like, oh, it's cool how he did that mastermind thing. Like the cool escape that he did at the end. And I love how sad it is. And this is so real. And then the older I got, I was like, man, none of that's real. That is like the fakest, schmaltziest, most like, you know, they're tricking you into feeling something just like sugar. It's just like it's total Hollywood, like just dreck. And I was like, man, okay, so I don't like this movie. And then I thought, well, I need to go back and revisit it. So I revisited it for this podcast. And I was like, man, this is even worse than I remember it. This is like a movie that wants really hard to be like a, you know, raw, searing look at what jail does to people.
Mm-hmm.
And then in every identical scene wants to be a cool, heartwarming, like, caper.
Right.
And it does that in every single scene. And the juxtaposition of doing both of those things at once is, like, disgusting. It's, like, gross. Like, how can you can't do that. Pick one. Like, if you want it to be silly, if you want it to be, like, Escape from Alcatraz, that's fine. I like Escape from Alcatraz. And if you want to be, like, real and depressing, like, also fine. But don't straddle the line.
Right.
Because like, then you get into, like, sickly gross territory that's like my least favorite, like, Oscar movies, like, always do that. They always, like, try to be real but then, like, are corny and when they shouldn't be, you know?
Right. And this really does seem like Oscar baity. Yeah. At its finest.
It distills the style. The only thing that's not, like, Oscar baity about it is the fact that it's not about, like, a real guy.
Mm-hmm.
So they just can't, like, make up shit about his life to like get wrong. But this one is, like, it's Oscar baity in the sense that, like, you are meant to leave this movie with, like, an understanding, at least in some small way, of how, like, prison works and, like, what jail does to people.
Right.
But the overarching thrust of it is, like, you got to be psyched that this dude got out, and, like, you got to care more that he got a bunch of money than about, like, all the horror that you went through. And it's, like, to juxtapose, like, an old man committing suicide with a guy, you know, crawling through a, you know, a poop tunnel to get out of jail is like that one too to me is like, can we just talk about the suicide for like a couple more minutes, you know?
Because here's the, I mean, there's a lot, this movie's, I forgot how long it was. Mm-hmm. There's a lot that they pack into this movie.
Yeah.
For a movie that's based on a novella, off essentially a short story, they thrust so much in here.
There's like a superfluous 15-minute segment where Morgan Freeman does like a narration of how, like, the prison industrial complex works and how prisons make money off inmates.
Mm-hmm.
That is, like, has the exact feel of, like, a Scorsese movie, like, describing how the mob works. Like,
right.
It's like, you know, going from, like, montage to montage. And you're like, wait, didn't like, this guy just get, like, violently sexually assaulted and then thrown into, like, a solitary confinement for a month?
Right.
And now we're doing this?
Yeah.
Like, how do we get here?
There's a lot of... It's, you know, when I was watching it, even just this morning, but to prep for this, it didn't really strike me the fact that this feels like two different movies.
Yeah.
And now that you're mentioning it, it's like, oh, yeah, there's a lot of like wacky capers and shit, like where to the point where if they just changed the music for some of the scenes,
mm-hmm.
you could have played a lot of this off as a comedy.
Absolutely.
Like this, like the thing that sticks out to me is when Tim Robbins is fighting off Boggs and his gang with a rake.
Yeah, right, right.
Which is like, that's if you put that in black and white and you put a jaunty piano song over it,
yeah.
That's something that would have been in a Buster Keaton or Charlie Chaplin movie.
Right, right. And then that movie, that scene in the movie is my least favorite of maybe all the scenes because it's the most, it's symptomatic of like the movie's like real tastelessness
mm-hmm.
because like they have that scene, and then a couple minutes before it, there's the first time he gets raped by the, like, you know, the official, like, sexual assaulters of the jail.
Yeah, they have a name, right? What's the name of their...
Oh, God.
The ladies?
The ladies, or something like that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the first time they do it, it's
the sisters.
The sisters, yeah, yeah, yeah. And Morgan Freeman's like, I wish I could say that he fought the good fight. And the camera does this move where it pans away from the action
mm-hmm.
and just kind of pans over to like a stack of boxes.
Yep.
And you just hear the violence and are meant to imagine it. And the idea that like you would show like the true, like, you know, how evil and awful and dehumanizing prison can be over the course of 2 hours. You do all of that. But at crucial junctures, you decide, oh, no, we're going to be a little bit more, we're going to be a little bit respectful and tame. But
right.
Do it in a way that's artful and suggests and titillates you and makes you go, oh, no, what's happening to him outside of the frame? It's like we are entertaining you and like using all the tricks in the like movie book to make you unsettled, but also like pretending to be like austere and respectful.
Right. Because that's the thing is like the movie comes out in the 90s, right? So in the 90s, especially the way people handle, I think, the idea of prison rape
yeah.
and just sort of gay men societally, They were like, we have to make sure that we highlight this, but we have to keep people interested and not want to show the grossness of homosexuality on screen. And that's just like, it's so weird to think like, if this movie were made in even like the 2000s or now, the part where Morgan Freeman's like, they didn't put anything in his mouth that day would have been the dialogue for that would have been changed.
Yo, guys, no homo. Chill. You know,
we didn't allow anybody to put something in that man's mouth.
Yeah.
We didn't know because they can't. They're dancing around it because I think they feel like they had to.
Yeah. Right. And like there's and even when like. The head sister Boggs guy gets like his comeuppance, right? Mm-hmm. He gets his comeuppance because like Andy works an in with the guards and the guards like decide to like, you know, get back at Boggs and then they make him so that he's, you know, a quadriplegic for the rest of his life.
Right.
And in the way that's filmed and the way that scene's supposed to like make you feel like you are supposed to leave that scene going, yeah, fuck yeah, we got him. Like, that's, right. Hell yeah, we got that guy back. And it's like, well, the guy that did that has killed, like, seven people.
Yeah.
Like, that's a multi-murdering prison officer.
But they keep it light by having Boggs be, like, do the grasping thing and before they pull him back in.
Yeah, no, that little slickness where it's, like, that little horror movie, like, yank is so, like, typical of the way this movie just pulls out the smarmiest little tricks here and there to get you, like, wound up. And, like, if it had been that, like, I wouldn't have had a problem with it. If it had just been purely just smarm and just, like, Hollywood cheese, that's fine. Mm-hmm. Like, cause I got to admit, like, the one defense of the movie is like, I will never, ever like not like when a caper comes together, you know, like all the little puzzle pieces fit in and you see how he got out of the prison. That's never not cool to me.
Right.
It's always sick. Any context, it's always cool to see a guy like sneaking around.
Yeah. Cause it's just fun. I love getting to see somebody swapping out books.
Yeah.
You know, and somebody crawling through a shit pipe and figuring out how to make things happen.
And the warden's like, oh, look at, he's got the pickaxe hollowed out in the Bible. Mm-hmm. And you're like, that's right, warden, we got you. And then it turns into like, they go right back from that, right into like Morgan Freeman's like rumination on like, prison doesn't change anyone. I have had my entire life destroyed because the system abused me in my youth. Like, and it's like, I'm thinking about the poop pipe. I'm still thinking about that. Like, why are we doing both of those things?
I think there's a way in which this could have been a more successful, like, it's hard to think about it now because I think it's like one of those movies that's very emblematic of its time.
Yeah.
It came out in the 90s. It's very much like they overstuffed it. It could have been something else if they had just held off and made it now, or even made it like the very end of the 2000s, instead of making it as a movie, do it as a miniseries.
Yeah,
do it as something where you can spend the time, you can get a little grittier with it, or you can make it wackier.
Yeah,
and you can do like an overt Stephen King comedy, which I would be totally fine with.
Yeah, yeah, like a 92 minute movie where like you barely know people's names, you get a real sense of the like dehumanization of prison, right? Like if this was just a movie about the objective, right? The objective is to escape. The objective is to preserve your human identity. If it was just about that and you stripped it away of all of the, you know, pleasantries and little things where it's like men drinking a beer on the roof, which I could talk about that scene for like
man needs a little bit of suds.
I expected a fucking Coca-Cola logo to come flashing across the screen at the end of that scene. It's like the way this movie is like shot and lit to be like just like the immaculate feel of an advertisement the whole way through. But yeah, if it had just been like, if it had been fun, it wouldn't have been an issue for me. Like I don't know, and you were saying how it was like a very 90s object. I think that's really true, especially in the way where it's like, this is a movie that's fundamentally like predicated on a twist.
Right.
Every 90s movie is predicated on there being a goddamn twist. Yep. It has to be some like, you know, Usual Suspects memento, like, oh, see what we did there with the script? He was breaking out the whole time.
Right.
You thought this was a heart-wrenching movie about, you know, sad guys in prison. Turns out it's actually a cool script that we wrote. Right.
And especially because they drop hints to it to where they're like, oh, there's no way he could do this. Literally from the very beginning of him setting up the scheme, when they're saying the rock hammer thing, oh, there's no way he's going to break out of prison with that. It would take hundreds of years to dig through. And it only took Andy Dufresne 19.
Yeah. And there's all these little clues here and there where it's like, you can call back to them where it's like, oh yeah, I did kind of think he was going to break out from behind the poster. Mm-hmm. It's like, it kind of rewards the viewer for like being smart and picking up on little clues here and there, which again, in and of itself, all of these things that like Hollywood does, they're fine in and of themselves. But when you put them in this context where you're also showing the absolute worst of the American carceral system,
right,
like, what's your priority here?
Yeah, because that's the thing is I think they're, you know, watching it, there's a lot of this that I like. But there's also a lot of it that I don't think is necessary to tell the story.
What do you like about it?
I liked elements of all the stuff basically after you see Andy get dehumanized and introduced to the prison system by basically being like raped and sexually assaulted for 2 years.
Yeah.
You don't need really any of that. I like the stuff where he becomes friends with the rest of these dudes in prison. I like the stuff. A lot of the stuff between him and Red, I like.
Yeah.
But the problem is you have all these other guys who we're supposed to care about, but I can't remember their names. I don't know the actors. You don't really care about them aside from Brooks.
Yeah.
And even that, I think they gloss over his whole scene, and the letter doesn't really make a whole lot of sense.
The Brooks sequence is one of the weirdest, grossest ones to me because they did just kind of throw it in there, and you don't feel like this is someone else's story that just kind of jutted in for like 7 minutes,
right,
which is like more than you'd expect, but not enough to warrant like mm-hmm. what his whole life is. And the way that that story is just like just pulling the strings, right? Just like making, just like twisting the knife in this poor old man, like, oh, the car is almost hitting him. Oh, he can't work at the grocery store. And now he's going to kill himself.
Right.
Don't you feel bad? And then it has another like all time just immoral shot where he carves his name into the thing and he commits suicide, and they do it the way every movie does where you just see his feet. That's fine. It's whatever.
Right.
But then they pull back from the Brooks was here carving in the like in the ceiling of the motel room, and they pull back to his dangling, swinging dead body shown mm-hmm. from behind, and then do a slow dissolve to the reading of the letter. The idea that you can do like this kind of like this sappy slow dissolve when there's a guy, it's a dead guy fucking hanging there, give him a little respect. It's like it's so gross to just like to just play that straight and just exploit this like guy suffering. And I don't care that he's not real, but you know what I mean.
But that's how you get away with putting this on TNT.
Yeah.
This is like, it feels like this is a movie that somebody, whichever studio head decided to greenlight this was like, we're going to make it okay for men to cry in movies.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Cause
yeah,
this is like, we need to find a way to get dudes on board with seeing this movie, which is why of course it makes so much sense that the thing that catapulted this movie to being super popular is it airing on cable constantly.
Yeah
it's like designed to be broken up and watched in chunks and because here's the thing about it, I'm 100% agree with you that it is like it's really schmaltzy and it really is very like puppeteer.
Yeah.
You can see the strings, but goddamn, there's something about this movie that I was watching it this morning and I was like trying to write and take notes and I just couldn't look away. Like I kept getting sucked in, and then I would notice like 30 minutes had passed.
Yeah.
And I was like, I can't not be sucked in and captivated by this movie.
I think it's because there's a fundamental like craftsmanship to it, right? There's mm-hmm. a fundamental like this script is like for all of its like abundances and like liberties that it takes with these stories and the fact that it is so long.
Right.
Like it has a tightness to it. It's building to that third act twist. Like there's everything in it has like little dramatic ironies where it's like, oh, he's got that little like crocheted Bible verse on the wall that's going to come back in act three. Or like he's got like, oh, he's going to make friends with this guy and then this guy's going to help him out later, that kind of thing.
Right.
And
or they'll even have the moments where they're like, ah, you know, you don't, you know, everybody's innocent in this prison.
Yeah, exactly. And then he says it then 15 years later and it's like, oh, I get it now. And that's what it does. It flatters your intelligence, right? It makes you feel like smart for picking up on these things.
Right.
But more than that, it makes you think, oh, the movie is smart for doing that.
Right.
Like you pick up on it and like, that's a smart movie and I'm smart for getting that. And then it's also like a very like pretty movie. And I say this in a kind of like pejorative way where it's like, this movie is like too handsome, the way it will like crane over these dead bodies and the way that it will like just sort of like when the guy gets shot and they like tilt up to like show him getting shot from behind by the guard. It's like, It's like, have a little respect for the dead. You
but
know what I mean?
That's the beauty. You have like Roger Deakins, who's arguably, I think, the greatest cinematographer currently working.
Yeah.
You have him lensing this movie.
Yeah.
You have Frank Darabont, who's obviously a very competent, you know, workman director who figures out how to like make this stuff work. And it works and it feels like it's crafted well, but then you step back and you're like, what happened?
Yeah.
How did I allow this to affect me this much?
But that's the thing. It's like, it's all the invisible little, like they're trying to make the strings as invisible as possible to make the strings that they pull on you to get you to cry. Like, they try to make you like not know that they're getting them on you.
Right.
Because then you feel cheated. But I have never felt like more like cheated towards like tears in this movie than in any other I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked your point about how like it is a movie for men to cry.
Yeah.
Because like at the end of the day, like the men are allowed to cry because you go at the end, oh, this guy is still the fucking man.
Right.
Like I'm crying, but only for a guy that is a badass and did the cool shit and was like got one over on the guys I didn't like and he beat those guys' asses.
Right.
You know, it's like that's when you're allowed to like cry that he gets to go hang out in Mexico. If he actually got like fucking ruined by a system and was powerless to fight it and was like ultimately betrayed by the inability of himself and his inmates to form like a solidarity against a system that destroys them, which is, I would argue, probably more accurate to most prison experiences.
Right.
People wouldn't like that. They would find it pitiful.
Right.
They would find him like, oh, this guy's weak. This guy's sad. I can't cry at this guy. This guy's just a bummer.
Right. There's a way higher likelihood that prison is going to wind up for somebody the way it does in The Night Of than it does in Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah. Which I saw like two episodes of that.
Night of is good, but it's bleak, man. It's just, you watch... What's the actor's name in that?
Riz Ahmed.
Riz Ahmed. Yes. Yeah. You watch him just go. He just goes through it, and like he gets demoralized, and he has to go through all this prison shit. And there's nothing cute about it. That's the thing with Shawshank Redemption. Yeah. It's cute.
Yeah.
Because it's supposed to be. I don't know. There's like whimsy to it.
You don't leave as bad of an image of prison as you should from this movie.
Yeah. I think there's another element of this, and I haven't talked about this aspect of filmmaking specifically on the podcast in a minute because it hasn't really occurred to me until this episode. The music. It's too Disney-fied.
It's awful, man.
It's weird, man.
Yeah.
It's so music obviously is very powerful in filmmaking.
Yeah.
And changing the soundtrack to a movie and changing the score to a movie can really affect the way you watch it. And I think that picking Thomas Newman for this, who's doing all these, you know, if you don't know a Thomas Newman score, if you watch the scene from American Beauty where the bag is flying around, that's the iconic Thomas Newman song.
It was between this and American Beauty for movies I wanted to talk about on this podcast.
Right. But that's the thing. It's like Thomas Newman is the king of making songs that are going to be like, we're going to make him feel something with this.
Yeah, yeah.
And he does that, and you can really see, I think out of all of the strings that operate this movie, the music is the thing that really cements like, oh, we're going to really get you going. We're going to stoke your emotions.
Yeah, music really warps scenes way too much. Like, I love old movies. Like, I love classical Hollywood. And like there are some great composers that worked in classical Hollywood, but at the end of the day, like most of those movies, as amazing as they are, had horrendous music.
Mm-hmm.
And this is very much in that vein where it's like, hey, you know what would make this scene better? 500 violins.
Right.
Wouldn't it be great if there was just a chorus of heavenly angels all the time, constantly instructing you what to think and feel about everything you saw? There's no room for ambiguity. There's no room for a shared understanding with the characters. There's only an understanding of what is imprinted on you in a moment-to-moment basis. And that's why I find the movie so smarmy, I think, because the music is a big tell of the intentionality of the artwork. Like, the effect that it has on you is we want to tug you, we want to rip you around, and we want to manipulate you, and we want to feel... As the people making this are superior to you, the viewer, you are pawns in our little game.
Right. It's manipulative, but not in a way that upon reflection is anything other than hollow.
Yes.
Like, it's it's got no actual substance.
Yeah, if it's manipulation that recontextualizes the behavior of the characters or puts it in a context where you might learn something new about them, like that manipulation is what great movies do. But bad movies just underscore the exact same point with every single aspect of their production. Like mm-hmm. they're always like this is a scene where Andy does something cool. You're going to like him for doing this. Or this is a scene where Andy does learns that it's okay that his wife died, and you're going to be cool with that too.
Right.
No lingering regrets, no feelings of like I need to like reckon with this part of myself that thought this. It's always in, out, this is what you're supposed to feel.
Right. I think that if they had streamlined the film and made it focus so much more exclusively on the relationship between Andy and Red and
yeah.
how
yeah.
Andy and his behavior and his attitude changed the way Red looks yeah. at his life and his experience in prison, then I think that it becomes more effective and still can do all of the things that it's actively doing
yeah.
without feeling so bloated. And without having all this unnecessary stuff in there.
Yeah.
It's just too much.
You mentioned how like bad like the first half hour is. The first half hour is like woeful when that like fat guy gets beat up and like killed.
Yeah.
And it's like you throw him in there just to kill him. You throw him in there just to be a kind of like a pathetic sacrificial lamb
mm-hmm.
where the rest of the movie is like, well, don't be like that guy. That guy was a fucking loser. I'm going to be better. I'm not going to cry my first night in the clink. It's like, well, but that guy just died. Like, don't you care? Like, don't we want to know more about the people that like are the worst off from the prison system?
Right.
Don't we want to know like where the pinpoint of the horror is rather than about this one guy who managed to like kind of skate around it because he happened to be good at forging tax documents?
Mm-hmm.
Like that's another contrivance that I didn't like. Just the fact that it's like this is a movie where this guy has a particular set of skills that
right.
can just get him out of jail like whenever he needs it, and that's like,
but then he's in another prison of his own creation.
Yeah,
man.
But then he has to learn to forgive himself and learn to move on, and it's like, okay, he's gonna live a perfect life at the end of this. We know that, like,
right?
Why doesn't he can't he have demons? Like, let him have some fucking demons. No, he has to have a perfect fucking life on a beach in Mexico,
right?
Like, I love when characters have actual problems.
Right. We don't need the Shawshank Redemption. We need the Shawshank Tragedy. We
That's
need this movie
right.
to like not have a happy ending.
Or we need, you know, just escape from Alcatraz. And
yeah.
it's just Clint Eastwood. I'm going to bust out of Alcatraz. And
mm-hmm.
that's all it is for an hour and a half, which is fucking sick.
Yeah.
Or it could be really sad. One of the two.
I've been looking at some of the notes that are on Wikipedia about this. First of all, my favorite quote just about this from the analysis section. There's a lot of analysis about
Wikipedia
this movie.
Analysis section is awesome.
Yes.
You get some real good symbolism there. The guy's really getting to the metaphors.
A lot of Christian metaphor, a lot of messianic
yeah.
stuff.
They don't miss it. They don't miss a thing, those guys. Those Wikipedia
especially,
guys.
Listen to this cogent analysis. Andy and Red's relationship has been described as a non-sexual story between two men. Just applause. Just congratulations for that. Figuring that one out.
I mean,
whoever did that, who did this? 34. This is from the Hollywood Reporter, Kimberly Nordyke. Good job, Kim.
Great job,
you really
Kim.
Got to the meat of
THR.
It's a non-sexual story.
They don't let anyone write for the trades, you know. You gotta
no.
be good.
You gotta be real solid.
Yeah. What else we got in there?
This film, it's the friendship is not built on conducting a caper, car chases, or developing a relationship between women. That's from Mark Kermode.
Mark Kermode, oh, that fucking clown.
I know, right?
Bozo.
It's the thing, it's like, I don't mind the relationship. I think it's the heart of the movie. I think
yeah.
it's the thing that is the most effective.
Yeah.
But it could have been fun if we had more caper. If Andy had not been the only one who was in on the caper, if Red was in there too,
yeah,
goddamn, this would have been a fun movie. Let's have a Stephen King comedy.
Yeah, I'm going to plug my favorite prison break movie of all time. It's a French movie from like the 50s called Le Trou, and which is French for The Hole, and it's about seven guys, and you know almost nothing about them, but it's all about the little tiny shared glances and ways that they just do the little gestures here and there to mastermind this incredible plan to break out of the prison.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all their little behaviors and all the little tiny things they do to make this impossible caper work. And you just kind of like fall in love with the rhythm and like the way that they kind of like go about their daily business of trying to get out. And that is like what is cool about Shawshank Redemption. Like the the like group dynamic as part of a overall plan. And it's not schmaltzy at all. It is also, and like this is kind of gets onto like the fact that like the relationship between Red and Andy is like a little bit underwritten there, mm-hmm. where it's like the whole La True is the gayest movie I have ever seen that doesn't have two men kissing. It is literally called The Hole, and it's like so much just like guys touching each other in really confined spaces. And like a little bit of like that, a little bit of like actual like danger in that is like can go a long way. And not like in a sort of moralizing like, oh, these guys are going to like rape you in like the broom closet kind of way.
Right.
Like actual like hair development. But I'm rambling.
But that's the there's so many missed opportunities, but it's not, I don't think it's for lack of desire to go down those avenues. I think it's just because Frank Darabont knew, he was like, I'm going to make this specific movie.
Yeah.
And I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. And again, I'll say it again. This movie, it worked on me.
It's a winning formula for a reason.
It pulled itself off.
Yeah.
There's a reason why this is still the most nominated Stephen King adaptation for as far as Academy Awards go. I think it got 7 nominations. Yeah, 7 Academy Awards. Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Cinematography, Best Editing, Best Sound Mixing, and Best Original Score.
And it lost most of those to the worst movie of all time, Forrest Gump.
Yep. I think it lost every single one.
Yeah.
Because Forrest Gump. And these are the other movies nominated for Best Picture that year, by the way. 4 Weddings and a Funeral, Pulp Fiction, and Quiz Show.
Yikes.
It lost to all of those, but most especially lost to Forrest Gump.
Yeah.
Which is a fucking travesty.
Yeah, that movie is gross.
Because Forrest Gump is another movie where you can see the strings at work in it, but an even grosser way.
They're way sloppier
than
about
in Shawshank
the strings.
Redemption.
They don't bury the strings. Yeah, because like I guess Roger Deakins is the difference, honestly, because there's so many moments in Shawshank, and I'll speak to Deakins being cool here. This is the thing that's good about it. Like they really do a good job of making it like casually beautiful, where it's like this movie like has a very sumptuous sort of like tracking shot across the prison as all the inmates are walking in single file line down to like the mess hall or whatever, and all of these little things are like, oh man, this is beautiful and really working on me, and you can really feel the authenticity. I don't feel that, but I see how it does that. Like mm-hmm. I can respect the craft if I think the craft is at its core immoral.
Right.
And gross. But yeah, I can respect that about it.
You can respect that. And that's the other thing. I think a lot of it is that Shawshank is a much cooler movie if you're looking at it from the sense of like the Forrest Gump is not going to get played and talked about for any great length because it's supposed to be just like fun and crowd pleasing.
Yeah.
In a way that Shawshank at least is like grittier. It's still a fucking gigantic crowd pleaser and it's designed that way, but it's R-rated as opposed to PG-13.
Tim Robbins is just a regular guy. And Tom Hanks is, boy, that performance, history does not look well upon that one.
No.
That's tough. Tough one.
There's so much about The Shawshank Redemption that I look upon the, like, I watched this movie a couple times and I'm just like, it worked. It really worked. And it says, you know, I really like the way you put it, where it's a movie that makes you feel like you're smart. It's a smart movie for dumb people. It's a movie for dumb people to watch and think, I'm smart. I get this movie.
That's why it's the number one movie on the IMDb list, because all those movies that are on there, you look at all of them, they're all about like doing tricks. Like most of those movies, you look at them like your Christopher Nolan movies, like Fight Club, stuff like that. They're all about doing things on a technical level that you notice and go, oh, this movie does technical things that I like. It must be genius.
Right.
Now, it doesn't matter that those technical things are obvious and like, you know, it takes you 1 year of like film studies to like really suss all those out. Mm-hmm. But it's just like those are the ones that the most people notice. So if you want to feel smart about watching movies, watch movies like Shawshank Redemption, because they will make you feel smart on a very facile level.
Right.
But I like movies that aren't perfect. Like it's better to me when a movie is like imperfect with real feeling than perfect with no real feeling.
Right. Because you can see the artifice in it.
Yeah.
I'd rather have something that makes you feel something but is a little bit jagged.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I like movies that like don't do as unanimously well because they're not as unanimously regarded as good. And people are going to say, I'm just a contrarian for that. And yeah, duh, of course.
Right.
Someone's got to be.
Oh, yes. Film snobs, I feel like, are more likely to be contrarian anyway.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's how we do.
It's all we have.
Yeah.
Like, we watch these movies alone. Like, there's no joy in watching movies with people. Yeah. It's all we have is trolling.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. What's your favorite movie this year?
Irishman.
Irishman?
I'm happy to go with the herd on this one.
There
happy
you go.
To go with the consensus. It is like I cried so fucking much.
And did you cry in a way where it felt not like Shawshank crying?
Yeah. Oh, I know I was manipulated, but it was like, I know I was being manipulated by guys who had been like working on this idea for like 50 years. The actors, Scorsese, the people he worked with, like the genre that he worked in has all kind of been building up towards this moment. Mm-hmm. Like the way it kind of like, have you seen it?
No, not yet.
Okay. Just the way the whole last hour defies the genre convention and just really drags you kicking and screaming into a life you didn't want to be a part of. And it's so harrowing to sit through and offers you very little in the way of hope. And I really felt like devastated and alone. And yeah, it's amazing. It's fantastic.
Can't wait to watch it. So far, my top one of the year is Parasite. I think.
Oh, yeah. Same problem with Parasite with Shawshank. It's too smart, too much of a contraption, right? Everything fell into place just so for me. And I like Bong Joon-ho. I love his movies, but it would have been better if it was worse.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I think we'll have to talk about that maybe another time.
Yeah, right.
Because we're wrapping it up. But, man, I think Parasite does it for me. But I can't wait to see The Irishman. Everybody's talking about how great it is. I got to just sit down and carve out that 3.5 hours.
Give it one sitting. Just really just hunker down and go through it.
I'm not going to do that mini-series bullshit
that people keep poking around about. That's a way to neuter its impact on you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to turn
great film into television.
I want to have it feel all at once.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the way you got to do it.
It feels long. It's a long one.
That's fine.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'll sit through a long movie.
Yeah.
I sat through 2.5 hours for this. I'd sat through a 3-hour movie the other day because I'm doing an episode on Scarface.
I watched a 12-hour movie one time over the course of 2 days. It's like an old French movie from the 70s, and it's like 8 parts, and like it's good.
Those pesky Franks.
I know. Yeah. Oh, wait, before we do go, I have to say this because my mother will listen to this. My mom lives in Memphis, and she said that she saw someone do a show in Memphis. She went to a comedy show, and it turns out that was you, and she wanted me to tell you that you were really good, and she really liked your set.
Ah, tell your mom I said thank you. If she's listening,
listen to this. She will definitely
you.
Listen to this.
Thank you, Ms. Fisher. I appreciate it. That's God, what a time.
Yeah.
What a spot. Well, Nate, thanks for coming on, man.
Dude, thank
you
for having me.
We get to talk about some man shit.
That's right. I feel
just
very
the idea of manliness.
Yeah, just busting out. No prison can hold me.
No.
These bars can't hold me. I would bust out of the prison, too.
Better get busy living or get busy dying. That's
Fuck
what
yeah,
I say.
I'm going
say.
To Mexico.
Yeah, that's right. Where can the listeners find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Nate Media Good. Instagram, same handle. I do a lot of impressions of Quentin Tarantino on
there you go.
And other things like that.
And you perform with a sketch team at the Pack monthly, right?
A sketch team called Brutus at the Pack Theater. We had our first show on Wednesday. Went pretty good.
Heard good things.
Yeah.
Come check that out. You can find me at Diet J on Twitter and Instagram, jlightcomedy.com for show dates. And if you like the show, tell a friend, leave a review, subscribe, join the Facebook group, the Patreon, all that good shit. You know what to do. Thanks again, Nate.
Oh, thank you for having me.
This has been Blockbusting. Go see something good for a change.